All right, today is Tuesday. My name is Ken Turley. This is our second lecture today. The title of my lecture is What's Love Got to Do With It? Anybody recognize that? Oh, I see a few fingers popping. Well, as I mentioned in my sermon Sunday, I have this sort of paradoxical interest in both things sacred and secular, and I draw on many secular sources of wisdom. So I'd like to share with you the words of that song, What's Love Got to Do With It? I'm not going to sing it. You must understand. What? Oh, if you'd likely. Okay. That's right, you did. All right. You must understand, though the touch of your hand makes my pulse react, that it's only the thrill of boy meeting girl, opposites attract. It's physical, only logical. You must try to ignore that it means more than that. Oh, what's love got to do with it? What's love but a second-hand emotion? What's love got to do with it? Who needs a heart when a heart can be broken? It may seem to you that I'm acting confused when you're close to me. If I tend to look dazed, I've read it someplace, I've got cause to be. There's a name for it, there's a phrase that fits, but whatever the reason, you do it for me. The chorus. Then I've been taking on a new direction, but I have to say, I've been thinking about my own protection. It scares me to feel this way. What's love got to do with it? What's love but a secondhand emotion? What's love got to do with it? Who needs a heart when a heart can be broken? Well, I can never resist these catchy titles and references to pop culture, especially when it's somebody as prominent in the music field as Tina Turner. But catchy or not, this question is legitimate. Even if the answer is completely obvious. In the song, Tina asks, what's love got to do with it? While she's trying to justify engaging in a romantic relationship as something purely physical, she's dramatically affected, somewhat dazed and confused, and while trying very hard to keep it contained, scared by the possibilities that the intensity of her feelings, in spite of her efforts to deny them, are something more than physical. It sounds, the words, the meaning, the effort of these lyrics sound very much like the line of reasoning that all people use who want to believe that there's no such thing as spirit or spirituality, no heaven or hell, ultimately no God. In spite of the efforts to keep life contained in the safe and comfortable confines of the physical and material realm, there's this nagging fear that, in fact, there is something more. Even with those who believe in God and spirituality, even those who embrace the rather forward-thinking theology of the new church, as George McCurdy referenced yesterday, even amongst those, there are those who try to keep their spirituality safely contained in the clear and concise definitions of rational understanding. And at times, even in the most intellectual of discussions, I hear echoes of Tina's concerns. As life has a way of escaping, one way or another, the safety of the little intellectual boxes we would like it to fit in. So the question remains and begs to be answered. What's love got to do with it? And the one word answer?
Everything.
I can sit down now. Absolutely. The answer is everything. When it comes to God, when it comes to humanity created in the image and likeness of God, when it comes to life itself lived anywhere beyond mere animal existence, the answer to that question is everything. I'm going to write something on the blackboard here. I was going to play the my favorite song of all rock and roll by the Quicksilver Messenger Service called "The Fool," but it's about 20 minutes long, and in the middle, there is this phrase I've just written: "Love is life," and then they reverse it: "Life is love." It's a common phrase. In the general sense, we've heard it said that God is love. Matter of fact, in our second hymn today, and if it's in a song, it's got to be true. God is love. Swedenborg says that the love emanating from God is the source of all life. Hence the phrase, love is life. The love emanating from God permeates all of creation, from the atoms that make up a grain of sand to all of animate life, to the most evolved of human beings and the spirituality within them. So in the general sense, love has everything to do with life. Just a few specific quotes from Swedenborg from the Arcana 33. "It's in everyone's power to know very well that no life is possible without some love, and that no joy is possible except that which flows from love." And I have to do a little Swedenborgianese translating here. "Divine good," meaning love, "and divine truth are from the Lord alone to eternity." And then in 1055, "In nature, nothing whatever is possible in which there is any union and conjunction, whether it be animate or inanimate, that does not derive its origin from love. Hence, love has been implanted in all things in general and in particular." So from this all-encompassing phrase, "love is life," let's get a little more specific. What if we're to add one simple word to what we've written? Oops. To "love is life," we add the word "the love is life." According to Swedenborg, the love is what defines us as a person. In AC 33, he goes on to say, "Such, however, as is the love, such is the life, and such is the joy. If you were to remove loves, or what is the same thing, desires, for these are of love, thought would instantly cease, and you would become like a dead person. Even the loves of self and the world have in them some resemblance to life and to joy. But as they are altogether contrary to true love, which consists in a person's loving the Lord above all things and his neighbor as himself," and then he goes on to describe how horrible that is. But the point here is that we are all animated by love, and we are all guided by the love that defines us. Each one of us has a primary love within us that defines who we are. It is something that we choose over the course of our life, and consequently, we bend all of our intentions and our actions toward its fulfillment. This is taking place to a great extent unconsciously, as it affects our fundamental worldview and defines and limits our vocabulary of response. And it takes place consciously as we make choices and arrange our life toward the fulfillment of that love, including monitoring and moderating our actions to ensure the continuity of life and the fulfillment of that love. Again, Swedenborg says in a brief statement, whatever favors any love is believed good. In other words, based on this primary love, which we arrange our life around, whatever favors that love, we believe it to be good, and we act on that belief. Now, I'd like to look at love a little more deeply, a little more detail. We're all, as New Church people versed in Swedenborgianese, familiar with the terms natural, spiritual, and celestial. And love being in all things is operating at all of these three levels at the same time. So I would like to propose some distinctions to help us understand these three aspects. The natural, as we know, is the physical, material realm, the most external, the most lifeless in a way, yet at the same time, the most concrete and accessible and the most and essential to manifesting all of these other spiritual dynamics as long as we're living in this world. So while it is the farthest from the essence of love, by no means is it not important. The natural love, let's try this on as a definition or maybe an explanation. At the natural level, love is the drive to engage and satisfy the physical and material hungers that come with physical existence, including the need for touch and contact, satisfied through social and sexual intercourse. We might substitute for the word hungers, desires, as Swedenborg referenced them as coming of love. But it's the drive to engage and satisfy the physical and material hungers that are part and parcel of being a spiritual being living within a material body in a material world. And I think beyond the obvious needs for food and water, the need for touch and contact is our fundamental need at that level. At the spiritual realm, which has to do with the intellect and the rational and the understanding, the informational, and the consciously intentional, love is the knowledge of and faith in the desire for mutual benefit that originates in God and flows outward through life, resulting in a person intending and trying to give and receive what is good and beneficial towards others and God. So at this level, we're operating out of our awareness and our understanding and attempting to do intending love in our life and attempting to do that as best we can. Regarding the celestial, which has to do with our emotional, our feelings, our intuition, that aspect of life that is not reasoned and thought out, but is nonetheless extremely powerful and extremely important, perhaps one might even say the most important aspect of life as a human being. At the celestial, love is the desire to become one with, resulting in a person intending mutual and reciprocal benefit for one another and for God. Celestial love wants to give all to others. Now, let me read one more quote from Swedenborg. This is, again, the Arcana 1735. Jehovah, or the Lord's internal man, was the very celestial of love, that is, love itself, to which no other attributes are fitting than those of pure love, thus of pure mercy toward the whole human race, which is such that it wills to save all and make them happy to eternity, and to bestow on them all that it has, thus out of pure mercy to draw all those who are willing to follow to heaven, that is to itself, by the strong force of love. This love itself is Jehovah. Now I remind you that as human beings we are created in the image and likeness of God, and when we human beings are functioning at the celestial level, these are the qualities of that love. Pure mercy, the desire to save all, to see all others in a good state, to see all others happy, to the willingness to give all that we have to make that happen. And this is probably as close to God as we can get. As human beings, we're operating on all of these levels at all times. We receive the influx of love from God. We create no love whatsoever on our own. Matter of fact, we have no power, no life at all on our own. All that we have that is alive flows into us from God. And then as a lens, we then manifest that out in a somewhat diluted, distorted, dulled version. And depending on who we are and our intentions to be of service to God, more or less bright or more or less dark. I did want to put in a parenthetical phrase that what I'm talking about here now is all premised on the assumption that God is an active dynamic in our worldview, in our conscious thoughts, beliefs, and intentions. Later in the week, I'm going to be talking about the opposite of love, and we're going to get into all the ways in which love is something other than this. So it's assumed that in all things, it can be really good and holy and sacred, or it can be really evil and dark. And so my point here is that I'm kind of saving that side of things to look at in more detail later. So the question arises, what in our lives is not based in and defined by and ultimately an expression of and search for our fundamental love? This is a flip side of the question, what's love got to do with it? Everything. What in our lives is not based in and defined by and ultimately an expression of and a search for our fundamental love?
Nothing.
That's right. We have in life our basic assumptions. These are things that we just assume to be true, often never giving them a second thought. We assume that when we jump, gravity is going to pull us back to Earth. For the most part, this is confirmed in experience. We assume, without thinking much about it, that tomorrow the sun will rise. And whether it's interfered with by the clouds or not, it brings heat and light to the Earth. We just assume this to be true. There are many, many other basic assumptions. Our assumption that the world is a safe place or not a safe place. This is an assumption that affects our attitudes and affects the way we view the world and the way we respond to the world. We have basic assumptions about our own self-image, our abilities, our attractiveness, about our personality, about our fundamental worth. These are informed by that fundamental love we have, and yet these assumptions often, as much as they affect our lives and the way we view life and the way we go about living it, we often do not think about them very often. And the most important basic assumption is the belief in God. Yes or no? I think there is probably no other single concept that influences the way we live and the nature of our experience in life more than the fundamental assumption that yes, there is God, or no, there is not God. Of course, if your answer to that assumption is yes, there is God, then there's the whole variety of beliefs about exactly what God is and how God functions in the world. But these are assumptions that we live with. And while there are some who self-reflect on these, and while we self-reflect on these to greater and lesser degrees at different times in our life, they operate as basic assumptions of our worldview and influence what we see and how we react. And these basic assumptions are extensions of that fundamental love that guides all things in our lives. Moving out of our basic assumptions, then come our basic values. Now, in some ways there's a little overlap here, but the difference as I see it between our basic assumptions of life and our basic values is our assumptions are what we believe to be true. Whether we like them or not, we believe it to be true. Our values are what we hold of value, what we aspire to, or maybe another way to say it would be what we wish was true. We have our material values, the degree that physical possessions are important to us, how we handle those, how we handle earning, what we devote our professional selves to. We also have our spiritual values. And often these function independently. Of course, it is better when these are married together and that this material serves the spiritual values. We're making value judgments all the time about ourselves, about other people, about our experiences in life and what we encounter. We're making value judgments as to whether they're good or evil. And as the Allman Brothers song say, all of these words get said, but ultimately it comes down to yes or no. There's another aspect of our values, and that's the kind and nature of our enjoyments. What is it that we enjoy in life? To see that that is an extension and an expression and the search for fulfillment of our basic loves should be no great stretch of the imagination. Given our assumptions, what we assume to be true, given our values, what we wish were true or aspire to, then we have our goals. We have our end-of-life goals, what we would hope we become and are at the end of our life, what we want to accomplish over the course of our lives. We have our daily goals, more like the tasks that we attempt to undertake in the hope of fulfilling that lifelong goal. In any situation, whether we recognize it consciously or not, we are operating with goals that are based on what we assume to be true and what we value to be true. In any situation, how we respond to it, we've got some sort of goal that we're attempting to fulfill. We also have in our goals those goals that are entirely personal and those goals we have that are engaged in or we have for other people. As parents, we have goals for our children. And the younger they are, the more appropriate it is we impose these goals on them. As the father of a 20-year-old and a 16-year-old, I am fully engaged in this dynamic and learning about letting go of imposing my goals for my children and encouraging them in finding their own goals for themselves. It's not an easy task. There's one final aspect of life. Given our assumptions, our values, and the goals that we're motivated by, we have our practices, the actually doing of things. And in here, I love this word practice, because it can mean something as mundane and familiar as going to basketball practice, or it can mean the religious practice of meditation. That word practice is so, I don't want to say all-encompassing, but so relevant to so much of what we do in our lives. We have practices. We have habits in our lives which we practice. Some of them may be very good and constructive. Some of them may not be so good and constructive. But they are the practices of our lives. These daily things that we do. It could be your morning cup of coffee. It could be your meditation. It could be your prayer and scripture reading. It could be going for your run. It could be your soap opera. It could be getting together with some friends. But we have practices that are ritualistic in the sense that we do them over and over again in very similar ways. There's the whole material realm, our habits, our jobs, our survival. And then there are our spiritual practices, our religious participation in religious groups and religious activities. And there are also our cultural practices, which we're probably often not conscious of. All of these aspects of living life as a spiritual being in a material world are based on, informed by, expressions of, and searches for fulfillment of that one fundamental love that is at the core of our being. So what does love have to do with it? Everybody? Everything. Love is at the core of who we are and defines who we are. So in our quest for spiritual regeneration, in our quest to serve God as best we can, in our quest to become the best person that we can, the most important question for us to ask then is, what is our fundamental love? And with that, I'll open the floor to questions, comments. There's a hand. For the sake of those listening later, would you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Marcia Kennedy. There's two points I'd like to make. I think yesterday it was mentioned that the Lord isn't in hell.
That what?
That the Lord isn't in hell.
Isn't
that God isn't in hell. But there's a statement that says plainly, though I make my bed in hell, lo, they are there.
I agree. I disagree with the statement that God isn't in hell. Right. I believe God is in hell. What happens is that people are closed off and resist and deny the presence of God.
And the other one's just a little thing that I thought was very beautiful. The first man on the moon, when he stepped on the moon, he said, who art the man that thou art mindful of him? And I thought that was, so those are just two little points.
Yes.
Thank you.
I thought he said, "Where's all the cheese?" But anyway, Jerry Lamole from Brynathyn, and I'd like to ask you if you could comment on the principle of the Lord giving us a heart of stone, or changing a heart of stone into a heart of flesh, and the idea that the loves we have are fluidic, not a static thing. Prioritizing our loves is important, from self to the love of neighbor and the love of the Lord, and flipping that over. And I'd like you to give some comment on that, because I don't have the feeling that our loves are this static, etched in stone. I think they're fluidic and have to be prioritized.
Oh, absolutely, I agree. We prioritize our loves based on that fundamental love, however. And it's not to say that fundamental love can't be changed, but we must make the effort to become aware within ourselves of what that fundamental love is. And then I would say about the best we can do is bend that love either to service of God or to service of ourselves. But you're absolutely right. Be it with that love and with everything else, there is fluidity. I mean, the whole concept of spiritual regeneration is based on the belief, the assumption, that we are able to change. It would be a very depressing thought to think that we can't change, and that we can't manipulate our loves and change them and prioritize them, and that we can't struggle with the loves that are, for lack of a better term, negatively oriented and positively oriented.
Emily Jane Lamole from Pennsylvania. Would you comment on the formation of the ruling love from the choices that we make, and how it's formed through childhood and then through adulthood, and how it gets to be what it is?
Are you talking about you or
everyone? Everybody's
the
ruling
general
love.
Thing.
How does the ruling love form?
Sure. Well, the first thing I would say is that I think the ruling love, the love, is implanted by God in each living being, and that in its original form is children. It's in its purest state. I think Jesus made reference to, not until you are as little children do you enter into the kingdom of heaven. And I think what he's saying there is there's a kind of innocence and spontaneity and truthfulness about the living in the state of that fundamental love that we can see in children, that often is repressed and contained and covered over and disguised as we become adults. I think it's beyond me to say how this is formed, because there's infinite variety. But the influences that we experience as children in our family lives both damage or dilute that love, but also inspire it and promote it, the whole idea of remains. And that love is bent and directed both by the experiences we have no control over that happen to us, and by the experiences that we do have control over and bring to ourselves by the choices we make. It's an ongoing process. And again, I don't think... Well, I guess we can the question of the eternity of the hells is the question of, is that love ever defined and unchangeable? At least in our life, in this world, it would be my belief that we can always grow and change. But the more you practice habits, the harder they are to break. And the more you live as in a certain way, the harder it is to become something else, even though it's theoretically possible.
George Dole, a couple of things. Swedenborg does say very clearly that the worst devil in hell still has that same inmost. And that is beyond our reach. And there's a statement in Marriage Love, a description of the soul as something to which nothing can be added and from which nothing can be taken away. So at the deepest level, there is something unchangeable about us. But he also says...
That's given by God, right?
Yep. Yeah. Like a lot of other things, as a matter of fact. Yeah. He also says that everything is constituted by not just by the direct inflow, but by the way in which it intersects with the indirect. It's everything is intersected. Right. And that inmost remains pure, but everything underneath it is in flux and changes depending on not only on our circumstances, but on what of those circumstances we accept and reject, what we internalize, what we, in Swedenborgian terms, appropriate. We like to think we're something, but we're item one, always in process. And love can never be conceived of as something that just sits. I think you were saying this very effectively. Always in process. We're a movie. We're not a snapshot. And we are very definitely then constantly in change around that central core. And I think the message of the incarnation is that the characteristic, the Lord's characteristic being a love of the whole human race, that what was different about him from us is that the context in which he lived was vastly greater. We have enough trouble getting along with each other, but let's forget about this whole world stuff.
Right.
First?
Yeah.
George McCurdy. In the writings, there are two things that I'm impressed with, the soul and remains. And both of them are said to be beyond and above even angelic comprehension. And the Lord is in complete control of them. And nothing can enter to defile them. Now, what we can do is layer on top of them. But the Lord is the one, I was thinking of Janie's question. She said, how does it form? Well, the Lord takes it and he forms everything in those remains. I mean, and they're beyond our comprehension. So to say, well, I want to systematically build those, no, it's in the Lord's charge. And I'm so glad that it is in terms of the formation and that nothing can destroy them.
It's in the Lord's charge, but we have a part in that process. Yeah. We can refuse to let the Lord work through us.
That's why I said layer.
That's right. And if one comment I would just make in response to that question about how we're formed, it's a fascinating thing to see how two people can go through the same experience and respond to it so very, very differently. You know, have some a mother can lose a child and never recover from it and just go off the deep end. Another mother can lose a child and bears the scar from that but goes on to work in an orphanage or something. And so there's some mystery there. But how we respond to things in our life and whether or not we're able to let God work through us and heal us, or whether we just close off, is a big part of the way we form in response to the events of our lives.
Lois McCurdy. I was just thinking of how it feels that my ruling love is changed, and it feels like this. If the first link, as we're taught, is your idea of the Lord, is your first link, and from that you build your ideas of the Lord and who he is and what he stands for, then as you learn that, and I love the idea of the spiral, that you love to learn, you learn, and then you apply it to good. And then you love another thing, and you learn what's good about it, and then you apply it. And as the spiral goes up, your loves can be altered. I should say your emphasis can change in your life. You may still love children, you may apply it in different ways, but your primary love may evolve like that and go upward. I'm thinking the positive side, that I guess there's also a negative side, that the spiral goes down.
I had a couple things in mind. First, about your statement that we're born with the ruling love, which would be called, I guess, an essentialist position, which I tend to share, but there is another view, and that is the existentialist position, which is that we create who we are. We create our love. And I suspect that even though we may be born with something, that it's what we create of it, what we make of it, that becomes the ruling love. And instead of thinking of life as sort of an arrow, you know, God pointed you, God shot you in a certain direction, and that's the direction you're going to go unless you decide to go the opposite direction, I've come to think of it as more of a cone of probability or a cone of possibility, that God sends you in a general direction, but there's this cone reaching out from you that represents the possible directions that you could go in. It's not fixed in one exact direction.
I agree completely.
And the choices that we make pull us one direction or another within that cone, so we may end out on this limb, we may end out on that limb, and I believe that this continues to eternity, that even in the spiritual world, our life is not fixed just because we've died. Rather, it sets us in a certain general direction. We're not going to deviate away from the boundaries of that, but we are going to be a different person if we make a different choice. Even in the spiritual world, I think that process of forming who exactly we're going to be continues. I also wanted to respond somewhat to what Jane was asking about, how does it develop? How does this ruling love develop? Because I suspect that if we're perceptive, we can see it early on in the children, but it manifests itself in different ways along the way. And just to use one formulation that's helpful to me, that's the hierarchy of loves that Swedenborg gives from the bottom up: self, the world, the neighbor, the Lord. And I think that in general, we do go through that progression in all of our loves. Fortunately, as infants, we're in a state of innocence with angels around us. So even though we're absorbed in self, it's not selfish in the usual sense, but it is self-absorbed. An infant is concerned mainly with its own comfort and not with the feelings of those around. I mean, if it's uncomfortable, it's going to cry, and it doesn't matter if it's 2 a.m. It's going to continue to do that. And there's no malice in it. It's just in a state wrapped up in itself, and the ruling love is expressing itself that way. A little farther along, the kids start getting interested in the stuff around them, exploring it incessantly. These are what we usually consider the schooling years when, I don't know if we do a good job of it, but we try to feed that thirst for knowledge about the world. This is the love of the world stage, and ruling loves tend to come out. Some enjoy one sort of thing, some enjoy another. Then there's love of the neighbor. As we mature, we realize, you know what, there's actually other people around here, and maybe I better start to treat them well and consider them to be as important as I am. And this, I believe, tends to happen in teen and older years, young adulthood. And the love of the Lord is a rather mature state. We may have a conversion experience early on, but I suspect that most of it is more still on love of the neighbor. We're learning how to care for others, and it's only later in life that we really realize God is everything, and that is the center. And through all of that, there's the thread of how do we particularly approach that? Is my love for children, is my love for music, is my love for clarity of thought and expression, is it for constructing physical or spiritual buildings, whatever, that thread is going to be running through, but it's going to change through those different stages.
I just had another observation about remains. I believe that there are also adult remains, because there are times in your life where something is so beautiful and so perfect, and you imprint it on your mind and your heart, and you can go back to that place. And I think that that's a remain.
Absolutely.
And I was going to say something else, but it can't be important.
I just suddenly felt moved to add that I remember that Swedenborg, I believe, said we always have to be in a state of balance between the heaven and the hell so that we have free will to choose either one, which is very important for our development.
Well, any other comments? Yep. That brings us to the end of our time. Thank you very much.